The first reading is a poem originally written for the 4th of July in 1893 by Catherine Lee Bates, but which eventually transformed itself into one of the most beloved songs of the United States of America. It's a long poem, but hear now these original words, which were changed over a period of 15 years by the poet herself. This is just one verse.
Oh, beautiful for halcyon skies, for amber ways of grain, for purple mountain majesties above the enameled plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, till selfish gain no longer stain the banner of the free.
The second reading is a piece written just this past Tuesday by my good friend and colleague, Jay Leach, senior minister of our congregation in Charlotte, North Carolina. Some of you may have been here for the sermon he gave 2 years ago to kick off our stewardship drive. That sermon at this church won a large financial award for the best sermon of the year, which seemed right to me because as I was sitting here on the chancel listening to it, I recognized that that's what it was. It was an astonishingly beautiful and wonderful sermon. These words helped me to get through the anxiety of Election Day.
It is such a simple, ordinary act, but today it felt different. I waited through the line at Precinct 90 this morning with our 6-year-old daughter in order to cast my vote. As we did so, I explained how all over Charlotte, all over North Carolina, and all up and down the East Coast and little towns and big cities, people were also waiting in lines. We talked about how in a few hours in every town and city from one coast to the other, lines would form and people would wait in order to play their part in our democracy. When our turn finally came, we navigated the ballot together, and she touched the electronic screen at each of the boxes reflecting my choices. We reviewed it all together before getting to that final screen. Now, she asked expectantly. We paused. I leaned down. When you touch that button, my vote will be cast. As I said these words, I found myself tearing up, a lump swelling in my throat. It's not the first time I've had that reaction, but today felt different. Once back in the car, we discussed how, for a long time, Lucy, my great-grandmother, whose home we're now restoring in Low State, South Carolina, couldn't vote. We talked about all the women who, for well over a century in our nation's history, were excluded from the ballot box. We talked about the suffragettes and how they advocated for so long in order for women to have their voices heard on Election Day. Then we talked about how people of color were turned away, how deceit and deception and outright shameless intimidation kept people from being able to participate. We discussed those courageous people who participated in the struggle for access to voting booth for all people. And we talked about how important voting is, no matter the outcome, and how wonderful it is to live in a free country in which we have choices. As we neared our home, our daughter countered that everyone still wasn't free. She continues to be disturbed by the way our state voted just this past spring against justice and equity for our gay and lesbian friends. Men still can't marry men. And women still can't marry women, she protested. My eyes filled with tears again. That, my darling, is why we have to take our place alongside all of those brave women and men who struggled so that women and people of color could be free. We have to use our voices and our energy and our money and our votes so that all of us can be free and equal. I affirmed my faith all over again to her. You will get to live through another great change in history and will be able to tell your children and grandchildren that you helped bring true justice and equity to our friends who are lesbian women and gay men. She bounded in the house to greet her sitter for the day, and I headed for the office on a dreary gray November morning. As I drove, I sang to myself, "Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain."
I don't know about you, but I always find the way my heart approaches an important election disconcerting, especially the election last Tuesday, because I was never one of the undecided. I had known for months what direction my vote would go all the way down the list. Yet because the machine gun polls were firing at me every day for weeks, missing me by a quarter inch or less, I was slowly growing convulsed with a gut-wrenching apprehension. I found myself dreaming of escaping it all on some distracting tropical island far away. And because every other moment someone sent me an email promising me the apocalypse after Election Day unless I offered $5 more, my native stability began to crumble. On Monday, I went down to Wilmington to visit a friend, and then I returned to have dinner with a bunch of younger friends who meet every Monday night in a sort of a salon. Distracted, I was distracted. Things were very quiet here in the office on Tuesday. I caught up on phone calls and letters as best as I could. But I assure you my work was unfocused. About 4 in the afternoon, I received the words from my friend and colleague, Jay Leach, about his experience of going into the voting booth with his daughter, Annie. Their pictures are on the cover of your order of celebration. And about their conversation in the car afterward, about the course of his heart while voting. I know Annie. I have some pictures she drew for me on my camera roll back when she was 4. I've known Jay since he was a Baptist minister who took a class with me at the Graduate Theological Union some 18 years ago. And I helped him to transfer his ministry into our movement, where he's been amazingly successful. We have been the closest of friends for years. And this last year at General Assembly in Phoenix, Jay and I had a 2.5-hour long conversation about death, of all things, that rose up in the ranks of the top 3 conversations of my entire life. I know Jay, and I know his wife, Melissa, and I know their daughter, Annie. But as I read what he wrote, I recognized that the Election Day story Jay told was not confined to my personal response, because I actually love them all, but had risen to be representative and emblematic of what democracy at its best can mean, which is why I wanted you to hear it this morning. Jay wept as his daughter lifted up her concerns, Annie, at age 6. Not entirely unknown in Unitarian Universalist families, my own experience confirms, but still, unlike anything that happened to me when I was her age, I don't remember any talk about elections, and I'm certain I never entered a voting booth until I voted myself for the very first time. Although it was certainly impressed upon me when I was a kid that this was an important thing to do, a true duty, capital D. I never heard anyone in my family complain that voting was just a waste of time, as I hear some folks saying even today. But even so, I certainly heard no family conversations about the issues of the day, Vietnam, or about any of the candidates. But Jay's piece reminded me of the expansive nature of democracy. He deliberately and lovingly included his 6-year-old daughter in the conversation about issues of the day and about the candidates. He sought her wisdom, sought her participation. And Jay then told his daughter some history, which involved his family. His great-grandmother couldn't vote because she was a woman. If he had traveled down the whole river of historical ways people use to keep some folks from voting, however, they would probably still be standing in that voting booth at Precinct 90. African Americans couldn't vote for many years because they were just that, African Americans. 4 states allowed freed African American slaves to vote, but I think you may agree that 4 is not a very large number. Early in our nation, Quakers, Catholics, and Jews were not allowed to vote. And had Unitarians existed in the state of Delaware, they wouldn't have been allowed to hold office after election, since anyone who was elected had to swear to fidelity to the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and the authority of both biblical testaments, according to their constitution. Georgia, for many years, had a law on its books forbidding anyone but Protestants to hold office, which didn't give Jews and Catholics much incentive to care about the political process. In the original Constitution, before all of the amendments, only white men with property could vote in an election for president or otherwise, or hold office. The poor could not vote. Even middle-class renters couldn't vote. Native Americans had land, but that land was taken away from them year after year, and most of them were not allowed to vote until 1924, only 4 years after women gained the right to vote, after decades of petitioning and demonstrating. Even though the property rule was rescinded around the time of the Civil War, it persisted in distorted form in the poll tax. If you didn't pay the poll tax, you were not allowed to vote. And if you were poor, you couldn't pay the poll tax. And so that took care of control over the voting booth quite elegantly and simply. I think you can see that democracy has always had to struggle against distortions and attempts to destroy it by means of the death of a thousand cuts. Demos and kratos, the Greek words that give us our words democracy, simply mean people, demos, and power, kratos, people, power. Demos is not anthropos, which means male. It means all people, regardless of gender. The opposite word in Greek, as well as in English, also taken from the Greek, is aristos kratos, or aristocratic. That is, the power of the elite. Power, that is, of the few, of the extremely wealthy, and of the self-anointed. Our nation was not in any way a democracy when it was founded. Not in any way. It was an aristocracy, since only landholding, that is, wealthy white men, were allowed to vote. Everyone else could go fish, according to the actual Constitution itself. Slowly, however, over the years, amendment by amendment by amendment, we have tried to make our nation a democracy and have come closer all the time to making that real. But, of course, many simply don't want the people in general to have power. They would rather keep it to themselves and restore the aristocracy. And in our own days, when women and Native Americans and African Americans and Asians and Catholics and Jews and Eastern Orthodox and Muslims and Quakers and non-religious folks, as well as Unitarian Universalists, can all vote, and in principle at least, run for office, we have another need to amend our much amended Constitution. Since the Supreme Court decided in recent years that corporations were people, that is, demos in the actual word democracy, the old aristocratic leaning of our founding forebears is making a decided comeback. Putting it bluntly, since I make so much money per year, and a large corporation makes a million times more than I make, easily, the power of the corporation, money being a distorted form of power, easily outmatches my own. The word bullying, so much in the press today, actually entered my mind as I was thinking about this. In other words, it is now possible to attempt to simply buy an election. Hundreds of millions can be given to the super PACs, which never existed when I was a child, and they in turn can influence any election with all that money, using the standard techniques of Madison Avenue, commercials, billboards, emails, so forth. The Move to Amend movement, which is championed by many within this congregation, is a clear attempt to restore balance to democracy so that persons are no longer giant buildings with beautiful boardrooms and gyms for employees and banks of lawyers to help alleviate taxes, but biological creatures like you and like me, with heads and skins and organs and personal histories. I think that since it actually was amendment after amendment to the Constitution, which got women and African Americans and all others the privilege to vote, the same thing can work, indeed must work, in the case of corporate personhood. I pray that our children's children never hear the word pack once in their whole lives. Now, the election on Tuesday demonstrated that United States demos, or persons, are not as easily fooled as people like Karl Rove imagined. All of his hundreds of millions in PAC money accomplished nothing, according to almost every post-election study. And he himself has been in boiling hot water all the rest of this week amongst his angry supporters. The demos, the people, it turns out, simply didn't buy that you could buy an election with money. Annie won't be able to vote until she's much older, which I'm okay with. I think an inclusive democracy is the ideal with which we raise our children, but that learning how to think about voting does take time. Children can be raised into it. We are not born with that skill. Jay and Annie will have conversations like they had until she can vote the choices of her own mind and her own heart. Annie's concern for same-gender marriage is especially touching for me. Not the least so because all four state issues dealing with that issue across the country surprisingly made it through the voting by the will of the demos, the people. What I think is especially poignant is that after that moving conversation with his amazing daughter, Jay found himself singing aloud in his car, "America the Beautiful," the famous song that many prefer to the actual national anthem because it doesn't lift up bombs and exploding shells, but prefers the more agricultural amber waves of grain. But what I want to note about that song is that it, like the Constitution, was amended over time. It used to have the lines, "O beautiful for halcyon skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties above the enameled plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, till selfish gain no longer stain the banner of the free." How I wish we could restore the original lines of that song in this era of super PACs and corporate personhood. But I also want to point out that this song was written by Catherine Lee Bates back in 1893. In that era, she lived out her life, 25 years of it at least, with another woman in the same house, in the same room. Whether they had intimate relations or not is completely irrelevant. Their Boston marriage, as such an arrangement between women, was universally called back then without any sign of distaste, and there were many of them, was the same gender marriage movement of its day. Catherine Coman, her partner, was chair of the economics department at Wellesley College, while Catherine Lee Bates chaired the English department. Both of them were ardent socialists, another word that no one seems to like anymore. Both of them were concerned about the income disparity of their era, so much like our own era. I think one day soon, I'm going to let Annie know about this history, as well as the history of her great-grandmother, and thank her for her tender concern for people like me and Catherine Lee Bates and Catherine Coman and so many others in her life. Speaking of thanks, Eric and I want to thank all of you who took the development of people power, democracy, seriously in this country by working the polls, and quite a few of you did, by showing up to vote in booth or on paper, by hosting candidate and issue forums, and by living through the emotional days of the election time with visible grace, no matter how churned your inner life, like mine, may have been during these last days. May we continue to vote with our lives, not just in a booth, but in our day-to-day decisions, all of us, each of us, for all the things that make life on earth a blessing for all, not just for some.